Begin and cry for nothing that might have been. Oh, I'd rather have nothing at all. Don't put your lips so close to my cheek. Don't smile, then I'll be unrecall. The kiss in your eyes, the touch of your hand, it makes me weep. Nothing at all. And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertone. So you see, I gotta say no, no, no.
Great Betty Otter. You should know this. This is also Black history. Should know these people. Betty Cotter, known for her unique vocal style, doing a lot of scatting and a lot of bending of the vocal cords. But that is the great one. Betty Cotter performing All or Nothing at All, which is by itself another classic, live in Hamburg, Germany in 1993, accompanied by Dave Holland on bass. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we pick up from where we left off yesterday. And where we left off yesterday was me talking about the hidden costs of white supremacy, starting at the point of my birth in Trinidad, talking about my experiences growing up in Trinidad, and gradually coming into a consciousness that a lot of what I was experiencing and seeing just wasn't right. There was great inequality all around me. But there was a system, there was an order, not mine, but this was the standing order that people in colonized countries have to live with. There's no rhyme or reason for why things are done the way they're done. But one thing is for sure, and that is you are conscious at all times that you're not totally in control of your life. Something else is controlling your life. And then, of course, I migrated to the United States in my teen years. Yes, I did have teen years. And a whole different consciousness overwhelmed me about how I was supposed to function in this society. And soon enough, it became clear to me that it might be different in the sense of the accent that you adopt and learn and speak, and the foods that you eat, and the way of doing things. But essentially, there was this sameness. And the intent was to reduce you, no matter what people were saying, the intent was to reduce you to a point where you absolutely must accept that you're being controlled by something else. It is not about a meritocracy. It's about a system that operates here remarkably like the one that I left, and remarkably with the same intent. There are people who had privileges and the rest who did not. So I wanted to know what you thought about that. We'll get to that later on in the program. But first, I want to share with you a contrasting view that says a whole lot. This is the view of Tim Wise, who describes himself as an anti-racism activist. This is a lecture that he gave some time ago. And what he's talking about here is a view of the society from a white man's point of view. And then we'll come back after he finishes this portion of the tape that I want you to hear, and then we'll have a discussion. All right, so here is Tim Wise talking about the cost of inequality. You know, I thought it was remarkable because I was talking about the hidden costs of white supremacy. He's talking about the same thing, but from a white man's perspective. Here he is.
I want to thank you all for coming out. I want to start off by telling you that I think it is probably a good idea, and I try to give this advice at most of my talks, it's probably a very good idea when somebody stands in front of you and is proclaimed by virtue of their bio and by virtue of their curriculum vitae, their resume, that part of which is read to you, by way of the nice comments made about them by others, proclaimed to be an expert, it's probably a very good idea to ask yourself why it is that you're listening to that person and not somebody else. In this culture, we are led to believe that if someone stands before you, a proclaimed expert, that it must be because they are indeed the brightest bulb in the box, that they know something that the other people don't know. I am not standing in front of you, and you are not listening to me because I am the most informed person in the country on racism or white privilege, not because I'm the best speaker on those subjects. I'm fairly good, and I intend to demonstrate that to you amply in the next hour. It is not because I'm the best writer on the subject, though I am okay with that as well. It is instead because I, and I know this, fit the aesthetic that is needed on too many campuses and too many communities around the country in order to come in and to give this talk. Nothing that I am going to say tonight, or at least very little, originated in my head. Nothing, or at least very little, of what I say tonight is in fact new. Almost every single thing that I'm going to say this evening is wisdom that has been shared with me either patiently or sometimes not so patiently by people of color who have in almost every instance forgotten more about the subjects of racism and white privilege since breakfast yesterday than I will likely ever know. And yet they will not be asked to give 85 engagements around the country this year or next on this subject. Not because they have not the wisdom to do it, but because privilege, the subject that I'll deal with tonight, bestows upon me that advantage. And so as a matter of responsibility and accountability, I have to own that up front so that when you go away from this evening thinking to yourself, my goodness, that was good. And I'm sure that's my subliminal way to tell you, you're going to think it's just great. And when you go away from here thinking that I have filled your heads with all this great knowledge and wisdom, please know that it is not mine. And the next time you hear it from a person of color, the next time it is shared with you, for those in the audience particularly who are white, the next time it is shared with you by a person of color, as it will be and as it has been in one form or another, please listen to it. And please know that it is from that source that I get virtually all of my material. We will know that we have made progress only on that day when a person of color can get up and give the talk that I'm about to give and be taken half as seriously as I expect to be taken. It's interesting to see so many people come out to these events, because to hear some people tell it, you would think that this conversation was almost wholly unnecessary. to pay attention to the American political process and what the candidates for this nation's highest office have to say and not say about the issues that are of importance to them, and thus we are to presume importance to the nation, you would get the impression that the issue of race, that the issue of racism, that the issue of discrimination, and certainly that the issue of white racial privilege were non-existent issues, that they were of really no importance or very little importance, because you will not hear and have not heard any of the candidates for presidency of the United States in either party of whatever political ideology make this an issue. Yes, they talk about poverty, and occasionally they talk about schooling and education. They talk about health care. They talk about all of those things, but not once have any of those candidates tried to directly connect the role that racism, the role that racial discrimination, the role that institutional racial oppression and white privilege play in regard to health care, in regard to housing, in regard to schooling, in regard to poverty. It is as if those issues exist in a vacuum and have no relationship to color, have no relationship to race, have no relationship to a history of racial subordination. What does it say about our nation's political process and about our nation's political and social culture that none of these candidates for office has seen fit to tell the American public the following things, all of which you would think would be campaign issues of some importance, at least to some people, and yet they won't say them? Why is it that none of them mention that it was last year, 2006, not 1996, not 1986, not 1976 or 66, but 2006, which witnessed the highest number of race-based housing discrimination complaints in recorded history? The Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, the year of my birth, and yet it was not 1968 that witnessed the highest level of discrimination complaints based on race. It was 38 years later. In 2006. What does it say about our culture and the politicians, the choices we have been given for leader of the so-called free world, that none of these candidates sees fit to mention as they talk about health care, which subject they do talk about with some regularity? What does it say that none of them have seen fit to mention the research that was published in the American Journal of Public Health in 2004, which had looked at 10 years of excess mortality data for African Americans from 1991 to 2000, looking at the number of black folks who had died above and beyond the number that would have died but for their blackness, in effect, and the social and economic conditions that ascribe and essentially adhere to blackness in this country. And what they found in that study, which received almost no media attention, again, published in an academic journal, not read by the average American, not read by political candidates, read by doctors and people who research the healthcare industry, but that's about it. This study found that between 1991 and 2000, there were almost 1 million black people in this country who died, who would not have died had they merely been white and had the average healthcare quality and access of the typical white person in this country. Had they been living in neighborhoods like white neighborhoods in which the levels of exposure to toxicity had been as low as it is in the typical white neighborhood, as opposed to excess exposure to toxics, pollutants, etc., in black and brown spaces. Almost 1 million excess dead people, in this case, black folks, who wouldn't have died had the system of healthcare access and exposure to toxics been equal between white folks and black folks. How is 1 million dead black people not news? You see, if James Byrd gets dragged to death behind a truck in Jasper, Texas, you will hear about that, and well, you should. If one individual is the victim of a vicious hate crime, you will hear about that, and well, you should. But if nearly 1 million people die, not because of bigotry, not because of hatred, not because of some white supremacist organization, but because of systemic and institutionalized injustice, you will not hear anything. How is it not news, and why are no candidates mentioning that according to the Department of Justice, in a study released in 2004, black and Latino males are 3 times more likely than white males to have their cars stopped and searched for drugs, even though white males are 4.5 times more likely to actually have drugs on us on the occasion when we are stopped? Now think about that. Because that suggests that racial profiling is not just racist. We know that. That is redundant. But it's also pretty stupid-ass law enforcement. Or is it? Because I guess it's only stupid if you think the purpose of the war on drugs is actually to get drugs off the street. Because if that were the purpose, putting aside whether or not we ought to deal with a medical and a health problem known as drug addiction with war metaphors in the first place, different lecture for a different night. Even if we assume that that is a good policy, let us be clear that that is not what we're fighting. We're not fighting a war on drugs, because the first rule of any war is to go where the enemy is. And if the white folks are the ones with the drugs in the car, and the black and brown folks are the ones getting stopped, the people fighting this war are either supremely stupid or just have, you know, really bad short-term memory. Like, they keep forgetting. Oh, damn, I pulled over another guy named Martinez. I keep forgetting it's white people. It's white people. Damn it, I got to write a note and put it on the dashboard. I don't know what's wrong with me. Maybe that's it, you know? Or maybe it's something else. I do trainings with law enforcement, not a hell of a lot, for reasons you can probably guess. And I ask law enforcement officers, what's the first thing you think when you see a young black or Latino male driving a nice car in your neighborhood? And they all, without fail and without exception, will say drug dealer. I then ask them, what's the first thing you think when you see a young white male, same age, driving the same kind of car in that same community? And they will say, without exception, without hesitation, without fail, spoiled little rich kid, daddy probably bought him a car. Keep in mind, we have been together for about 90 seconds of the workshop at this point. We have 2 hours left, and they have just outed themselves as racist, because what they have said is that they are making snap judgments on the basis of only color, that work to the detriment of people of color, the benefit of white people. We still got 2 hours to go, so you know it's going to be fun from that point forward. These are people sworn to protect and to serve. It's right there on the car, right there on the side of the car. And in the first 90 seconds, they are acknowledging these racial biases. How is that not an issue? How is it not an issue that, according to that Justice Department report, while black and brown folk are having their wheel wells ripped apart on the side of the road, their trunks splayed open, their dashboards ripped apart in the search for drugs, which aren't even there, white people like me, notice I said like me, because I'm not trying to tell you anything about me that you don't need to know and for which the statute of limitations has not yet expired, are driving by the roadblock with a trunk full of weed, and we're just waving. Because we're not suspected, therefore we're not detected, therefore we're not punished. How is that not an issue? How is it not an issue that the typical white family in America, thanks to this history, this legacy of institutionalized oppression for some and advantage and privilege for others, how is it not news that the average white family in America, not the average rich white family, the average white family has 12 times the accumulated net worth of the average African-American family, 8 times the accumulated net worth of the average Latino family, in large measure because those white average families have had parents or grandparents who, even if they didn't have much, even if they were not rich, nonetheless were able to procure a little house, a little property, maybe with an FHA or a VA loan in the middle of the 20th century, loans that were all but off limits to people of color as they gave hundreds of billions of dollars worth of assets and equity to those who were white, so that even white working class families on average, even white families with less than $15,000 a year in annual income, which, depending on family size, that is technically, legally the poverty limit. And yet the average white family with low income, less than $15,000, has the same average net worth as the typical black family with $60,000 or more in annual income. So that even those African-American families that are professional, good jobs, occupational status, good educations, et cetera, and pretty good incomes are still in worse shape in terms of wealth and assets, material goods, which are really what matter in the long run, your income. If you're dependent on that, you're one paycheck away from nothing. If you don't have assets, if you don't have wealth, if you don't have something accumulated, your income means very little. In the case of an economic downturn, and these working class white families who are struggling, make no mistake about it, nonetheless are on average going to be better off than those black families with 4 times as much annual pay. How can that not be an issue? I am suggesting to you that the failure to talk about race, the failure to talk about racism and inequality on the basis of color, feeds the denial that is already far too prevalent among the white community. And having been white all of my life, I've been surrounded by that denial for a very long time. A few years back, white Americans were asked whether or not we believed that racial discrimination was still a significant national problem for people of color, or whether it was just a problem, you know, like junk mail, wrong phone number, 2 a.m, you can't get back to sleep, it's raining and you want to go outside for a jog, you know, a problem, but one you'll get over, you know. Whether it wasn't much of a problem, wasn't a problem at all, or we just weren't sure. They also asked black and brown folk this question. Folks of color, it won't surprise you, said, yes, it is a significant problem, actually, and not just because I read about it in a sociology textbook. I actually have lived it and would be more than happy to tell you what kind of problem it's been, but these were pollsters, man, they didn't care about that. They just wanted the yes or no, then they were on to the next house. Then they asked white folks, is it or is it not a significant national problem, racial discrimination for people of color and against people of color, and only 6%, 6 out of 100 said yes, that it was a significant national problem. Just to give you an idea of how bad that is, I would have you compare it to a survey taken a few years earlier where approximately 12% of white Americans said we believe there was a fairly decent chance that Elvis Presley might still be alive. I don't know how good you are at math. I'm not very good myself, but that's a ratio that I can calculate. What that means is that white Americans are twice as likely to believe that Elvis might still be alive than we are to believe what people of color tell us they experience on a fairly regular basis. That is denial so profound as to boggle the mind, but there it is. And the people who are saying it are not mean-spirited, they're not hard-hearted, they're not bad people. I firmly believe that most people are good people. I could be wrong about this, but I have 2 little girls, ages 6 and 4, and I choose as a parent to believe that most people are good. If you have evidence to the contrary, keep it to yourself. I do not want to know it or hear it this evening. What I do know is that those individuals who said that, as well-meaning as they may have been, that they really didn't see it as a significant problem, aren't new in their denial. See, it's one thing for young people to think that the problem is solved. I almost get that. I almost understand it, because if you're under the age of 25, maybe even under the age of 35, what you know, what we tend to know, younger people, about this history and about this legacy is what we see in that grainy black and white footage every MLK Day, or maybe during Black History Month. If I were to ask you, do you believe that folks of color had equal opportunity and were treated equally in this country in 1963? Or whether or not black children were treated equally in schools and had equal educational opportunity in 1962, I know right now that no one in here would say, well, of course, you know, naturally they did. 1963, that was a damn good year to be black or brown in America. What are you talking about? Everyone, regardless of your position about 2007, would quickly acknowledge how bad it was back in the day, because it's no sweat off your back. 44, 45 years later, it's easy to talk about how bad it was. But now, see, here's the trick. What do you think white folks said when those very questions were put to them in 1963 and in 1962? At a time when the apartheid system in this country was very much in full effect. It was before the Civil Rights Act, before the Voting Rights Act, before the Fair Housing Act. In retrospect, we can all look back and say how profoundly unequal it was. How profoundly unequal it was. And yet when white folks were asked, some of them our parents, our grandparents, great uncles, great aunts, these ancestors of ours, right, were asked the very same question in 1963. Do you think that people of color, they didn't use that term, it said racial minorities. Do you think that racial minorities are treated equally in your community? And 80% of white folks said yes. In 1962, when Gallup asked, do you think that black children receive equal educational opportunity in your community? 90% approximately of white folks said yes. Nothing to see here. What is all this complaining? What is this march on Washington? I don't get it. I don't understand it. In fact, the very month of that march, which now it seems like every white liberal wants you to believe they were at. The very month of that march, white folks were asked by Newsweek what they thought about it. They said 2/3 of whites said that Dr. King and the movement were pushing too far, too fast, asking for too much, and too soon. The idea that this country was ready to hear this, even at the time when we know how vicious it was, is a lie. What does it say that white folks were in denial in 62 and 63? What does it say that if you'd gone back to the 30s and asked the question, you think white folks were clear then? The 1890s, What did white folks say, those southern editors of newspapers where I'm from? They would say, we get along fine with our Negroes down here if you Yankees would just leave us alone and stop messing in our business. Go back to 1850 and read what Dr. Samuel Cartwright, a well-respected member in good standing of the medical profession in this country, said. Not only was racism not a problem, there wasn't even a word for that yet, slavery wasn't a problem, so much so that he decided that any slave who would run away obviously had a mental illness. Because you'd have to be crazy to run away from bondage. So he came up with a term, he called it drapetomania. Don't even know what the root of that is, don't want to know, don't understand where the word came from, but that's what he called it, drapetomania. You must be crazy, you must be mentally ill to run away from your loving master. Denial. In every generation, 2007, 1963, the 30s, the 1890s, the 1850s, my point being that in every generation, members of the dominant group have said there is no problem. And in every generation, without fail, we have been wrong. And in every generation, people of color, those who were the targets of that oppression and subordination, have said there is a problem. And in every generation, without fail, they have been right. So the question for us today is, what are the odds, honestly, that people of color who have never gotten it wrong have suddenly lost their frickin' minds and have suddenly become unable to see truth and to separate it from fiction? And counter to that, what are the odds that white folks who have never gotten it right yet have suddenly become highly, highly perceptive? The odds are pretty long. And again, it's not because white folks are insensitive or hard-hearted, let alone stupid, but it is that those of us who are white have the luxury of not knowing black and brown truth. We don't know because we don't have to know. We are not tested on it. If I don't know what people of color experience, what happens to me in this country? Virtually nothing. But if people of color don't know my reality, if people of color don't know white reality, better than white folks have to know it. If they cannot regurgitate it to us better than we would ever be able to regurgitate it to ourselves, all hell breaks loose. So people of color are going to have to know white history, white literature, white art, white theater, white poetry, white drama. I know we don't call it that. That's sort of the point. When your stuff is the stuff against which everybody else's stuff is compared and found lacking, you don't have to name it. It's just the norm. That's why, for those still confused, we don't have White History Month, because we have several. They go by the tricky names of May and June, July, August, September. Pretty much any month that we have not designated as someone else's month, that's White History Month. But we take it for granted because we don't have to know other folks' reality. That's a privilege. That's an advantage. That's a head start. And it's one we must think about. See, that's the other piece of this, right? It's one thing for white folks to acknowledge racism. Because, you know, white liberals will. God bless them. White liberals will acknowledge that racism is real. Oh, my goodness, we should do something about that. Yes, yes, we should. It's terrible, that racial profiling, that housing discrimination. My goodness, it's awful. Yes, 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 it is. But just because we acknowledge racism and discrimination doesn't mean that we'll necessarily acknowledge the flip side of that. Doesn't mean that we will acknowledge that for everyone who's targeted by that discrimination, which we're willing to admit exists, there is somebody else not being targeted, guess whom, and that those individuals are elevated by definition and receive an advantage, receive a subsidy, receive a privilege in the process. You see, we like to talk about those who are down as if there is no up, right? We like to use language that obscures the interrelationship of down and up. Now, down has no meaning without an up. It is a relative term. But we talk about those at the bottom of the hierarchy, not paying attention to the fact that for anyone who's down, someone is above them, and they're above them because they're down. We use this language that makes it impossible. And when I say we, I don't mean like right-wing folk. I'm not even talking about them. I'm talking about nice, liberal, caring service providers. Right? People who just want to help. Right? I just want to help the underprivileged. That's the word we use. I've used it before. I don't use it anymore, except in a speech like this. Right? We just want to help the underprivileged. But what's wrong with that word, folks? At least two things that ought to be pretty obvious to you, right? Number one is it's a passively constructed term. right? It's the passive voice, as my English teacher would say. Underprivileged doesn't imply that anybody did anything to anyone. It's just there's privilege and I will be damned. There you are under it. We could just figure out how you got down there. We could solve all the problems of the Western world. But we don't want to know how you got down there. No, that's why we came up with that bumper sticker. Stuff happens. That's the G-rated version. That's a bumper sticker that only a straight, white, upper middle class male could have made. Because anyone who isn't straight, anyone who isn't male, anyone who isn't white, anyone who isn't upper middle class knows that stuff doesn't just happen. Stuff gets done by people, to people. Nothing is a coincidence. Nothing is random. It isn't osmosis. And so we act as if it's some passive thing, but yet that's not the case. And the second problem with the term underprivileged is even bigger than the first one, is it's a relative term. Again, this is grammar. Man, you don't like this? You can disagree with anything else I say tonight. If you have a problem with this piece right here, you must take it up with your third grade grammar teacher, because it is not on me. If we use the word underprivileged, then by definition, there must be an overprivileged, but we don't use that word in polite conversation. Indeed, it doesn't exist in any dictionary to be found on the planet. If you don't believe me, go back to your res hall, go back to your apartment, go back to your home, go back to your place of employment. And tomorrow I want you to punch in two little words. The first one, underprivileged. Make no mistake, your spell check is going to recognize that word. It's in their dictionary. They can give you the definition. They can give you the synonym. They can give you the antonym. They can show you the phonetic way in which you should spell it. Now come down one line, type in the word overprivileged. And watch how fast that little red line pops up. That line which says, nope, you're an idiot. Making up words that don't exist. Try again and get back to us. But if there's an underprivileged, there must be an overprivileged. Why don't we talk about it? Because that would require that we acknowledge that if there are 2 to 3 million people being targeted for race-based housing discrimination because they are people of color every year, that is 2 to 3 million more places I can live. If people of color are being targeted and profiled and I'm not, that is an advantage. It may or may not have material consequences. A lot of privilege isn't about material acquisition, so please know this. When I talk about white privilege, I don't even mean money necessarily. For some, it definitely translates to that. For some, it has certainly meant that. But even for those white folks who don't have that money, white privilege is real at the psychological level. Well, I grew up for the first 18 years of my life in an 850 square foot apartment where the plumbing was always leaking, the air conditioning was constantly busted, we had no savings, we ran cars into the ground until they just stopped running, took no vacations, had no assets, had no credit that wasn't bad credit. So I was one of those white folks who certainly didn't have class privilege, and yet I had the knowledge that I was perceived in school as highly capable, not because of my class background, which was no great shakes, but because I was seen as a bright, capable white child, and students of color who were every bit as capable as I were tracked low while I was tracked high. I could make bad grades, and I never seemed to fall out of favor in those types of classes because I was seen as simply underperforming, not quite living up to my standards, you know. So I received the psychological edge of knowing that in those classrooms, if I didn't do well, and I often didn't, I was a bad student. But if I didn't do well, I never had to worry that that would be ascribed to my race. I never had to worry that someone would say, well, of course he's not good at that because, you know, he's white. Because unless I was going to be trying out for a job that involved jumping or dancing, what stereotype exactly is working against me as a white person? There aren't many. But for people of color, it's a whole different ball game. Knowing that if they underperform in an academic environment, knowing that if they end a sentence with a preposition when they answer that question in class, or if they mispronounce a word, or if they simply answer the question wrong, they have to wonder whether they dropped the ball not just for themselves, but for all those coming after them who look like them, whose presence on that campus or in that job complex, in that office, is constantly under scrutiny, constantly being questioned, constantly being double-guessed, second and third and fourth guessed. Do they really belong here? That's what it means to be white, is never having to worry that you're going to trigger a series of negative stereotypes about your group, and if you're not able to overcome them, your opportunities will be limited. Yes, white women will face that on a gender level, but on a racial level, Those who are white will never have to worry that their missteps, that our missteps, will be attributed to our racial defect of some sort. And the research is very clear that that privilege, having one less thing to worry about, having one less thing to sweat in the classroom, trying to get the loan at the bank, at the job, or whatever the case might be, that that has significant dividends. Because to have one less thing to sweat in a competitive society is the thing that separates oftentimes success from failure, or big success from medium success from smaller success. And the research is very clear that on an academic environment in particular, those persons who are constantly having to worry about whether or not their performance is going to trigger that negative group stereotype, that the mere anxiety caused by worrying about that is enough to drive down academic performance on standardized tests and in classroom performance, even when they are equally or better qualified than their counterparts who don't have to think about that. So it's a huge advantage to have that one less thing to concern oneself with, to not have the burden of representation, to not have to, in the parlance of the modern era, hold it down for white people. Because we as white folks know we don't have to do that. We also know that what other white people do won't stick to us. We have 19 men who happen to be Arab and Muslim who fly planes into buildings, and we have otherwise rational human beings running around insisting that we should stop and search everyone like them at the airport. We did not do this or anything even remotely like it when Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols brought down the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, nor would we have. We didn't do it when the Unabomber, crazy-ass white man in the woods of Montana, blowing people up for 20 years before they caught him. It didn't stick to the rest of us who were white men. The Olympic Park bomber, Eric Rudolph, puts a bomb in Olympic Village in Atlanta in 96, blows up a gay bar, blows up a family planning clinic. He too then runs off to the woods. As a side note, I have no idea what it is about white people and the woods. But whatever it is probably explains why black folks don't do a lot of camping. So it doesn't stick to us. There have been over 125 family planning centers, some of which provide abortion services, many of which do not, that have been bombed or burned in the last 20 years. And every single one of them, according to the FBI, have been white. They've mostly been men. They claim to be Christian. Different lecture for a different night. 125 or more. 125 plus McVeigh and Nichols is 127. Unabomber's 128. Eric Rudolph is 129. 129 confirmed terrorists who are white in this country in the last 20 years. It sticks to nobody who's white. 19 Arab Muslims, and it sticks to everyone who is either 700 million Arab folk on the planet, 1.5 billion Muslims on the planet. To assume that we know something about them based on the acts of 19 is to commit what any statistician will tell you is sampling error. It is mathematical illiteracy. And yet we do it because we can. Privilege, not having to worry about it. But let me suggest to you something, because the title of this talk, after all, is The Pathology of Privilege, and I want to be very clear. That privilege of not thinking about it, that privilege of not having to know someone else's reality, that privilege of being able to ignore it, and the privilege of benefiting from the inequality, having a certain leg up, actually is very dangerous. And not just for those who don't have it, that there is actually a downside for those who do. And this is important, right? Because in a country like ours, which encourages us to take advantage of our advantages, if I tell you that you have privilege, your first inclination is not to try to get rid of that. That's not the culture in which we live. But I want to suggest to you there are reasons why even those of us who benefit in relative terms from racism and institutional white supremacy should care about this, not out of some altruistic, I want to help other people impulse, but because it is actually dangerous for us as well.
Tim Wise, giving his perspective on certain pillars of white supremacy in the United States. Well, if you happen to have listened yesterday to how it came to me about certain aspects of the world that will govern my life, and my parents trying their very best early on in my life, and they were not alone, they anticipated what would happen, likely happen to their children, and they did their best to put in our path something of a defense. I didn't see that at the time, growing up, but my parents, who had 9 children, certainly saw it, and to the best of their ability, just like most black parents would, they tried their very best to construct a way out, a trap door, because they knew that at some point soon in our lives, we will be trapped by a system that would have greater power than we did. So I thank them for that. So if you listen to that and you listen today, what are your thoughts about the social, political, economic, and even psychological construction of oppression and white supremacy? 888-874-4888. We have some time to take a couple of calls. What are you thinking? Connecticut, Gabriel, what are your thoughts?
Hello, you cheese.
Hello.
I find it very compelling to bridge what you said yesterday about the sabotage of life, that your life or the jeopardizing or the potential for sabotaging your life took in many different narratives when you spoke so eloquently about your, I would say, your biography or your journey, your journey. And our greatest power or the white supremacist greatest power over so-called blacks is that they control everything that we believe. They control our education, the news, the media, the entertainment, all the statistics, all the negative derogatory criminal records, and even the image of ourselves. This is therefore allows the oligarchs and the powers that be to really saturate and inundate blacks with false disinformation designed to instill anger, self-help, self-hate, self-degradation, and devaluation of the people. The myth is this. The myth is that white superiority and black self-hatred into our minds. It is a psychological warfare program used for the protection of white dominance. That's what's really occurring.
I think so. But I don't think it's just, I think you pointed this out, it is not just a black-white dynamic, because you have, all throughout Africa, you have the same equation, but with blacks, you know, heaping suffering, untold types of suffering on their own people. So it is actually a system that we have to pay attention to. And I talk about systems all the time. You have to be aware of how systems work. In the United States, it happens to be a black-white dynamic. In other countries, it's the same race. It's the same culture. But the dynamic is about one group dominating and overpowering the other. The race-based system of exploitation is here. It was in South Africa. So it's not just, it isn't one set formula. It is a system designed to empower one group and completely disempower the other.
Yes, that's true. But remember Frances Cress Wesley and what she has to say about that. If you want to be so inclined to extend the conversation towards the pathology or the deranged self-hate if you wish to extend the conversation to overseas and how Africans treat other Africans, we are brainwashed to worshiping a European God set. And that is probably one of the fundamental schisms of the pathology being projected and being implemented on our own people. We have a history that predates 50 to 100,000 years. Why, within the last 2,000 years or so, that we are worshiping a prophet and a religious Catholicism that doesn't predate our great history of Okebalon, Kemet, Kush,
well,
Ethiopia, Sudan?
That is a much more complex question, but I just wanted to take a small peek at how it plays out in the United States and possible reasons to explain our current condition. And, of course, the conversation should continue. Thank you for starting us off today. Henry, haven't heard from you in a while. In Chicago.
Hey, you freeze. How's it going?
Okay.
You haven't heard from me because I've been under the weather.
Oh, wow. And I know Chicago is brutally cold at this time of year.
Yeah, and it's about to get warm again, so more people are going to get sick. But in regards to the topic at hand, you know, when I first started listening to Tim Wise, let me just say this. You know, the system of white supremacy, you know, I'm still learning it. I'm still trying to uncover and peel off, what we see within the system, because it's hidden in our society as well as, you know, out front as well. So when I listened to Tim Wise, you know, when I first started listening to Tim Wise, I thought I was like, oh, okay, he sounds sensible. But it seems like the more I listen to him, the more he seems to use that word white privilege a lot. And not to say that white privilege is a problem, but he seems to make it the main issue. And when he started talking about the white terrorists, and see, this is the thing that got me when you played that speech from him, because he kept using white privilege gave Timothy McVeigh and the Unabomber these methods of doing what they did, and I'm like, to me that sounds more like white terrorism than white privilege.
No, but he did call it, these are acts of terrorism. All of those that he enumerated were acts of terrorism that worked in one way for the whites committing acts of terrorism, and Arabs vis-a-vis the World Trade Center bombing committing acts of terrorism. Even in that sense, he said there is a differentiation.
Yeah. So, you know, he seems to confuse me more and more when I talk to him about it, because I don't know. I guess with me, like I said, as I'm learning about the system of white supremacy, you know, and learning about, you know, what is privilege, what is white terrorism, what is white domination, you know, it seems to me that this is more than just, you know, a United States thing. This is, you know, like you, I think you mentioned this before, that this is a global thing, because, you know, mm-hmm. you stated yesterday that, you know, it started in your home country. So I think the thing is that, and this is another thing that I tried to understand from Tim Wise, is who's the audience he's talking to when he talks about white privilege? Is it black people or is it white people?
I think in this particular speech, it was mostly white.
Okay. Because honestly, I think majority of white people understand their white privilege. And I think they understand white supremacy, if you ask me. So, I mean,
well, I think it's the same thing, but the words are used in a different way. White supremacy gets straight to the point, and you know it's confrontational. It's confronting you in your face with something you've probably not considered before. A speech, the way I read this speech, was it was educational. It was preparatory. It was introducing the ideas. You don't want to blast. You don't want to blast people. In some instances, you know, full blast. They have to be gradually introduced to ideas, in order to feel comfortable, so that they don't feel they're being blamed for something. So you use different phrases and you do use different methods of bringing them into what you would think is a safe zone for them to entertain the idea. This, I think, was his first speech to this group, because he mentioned, you know, coming back later on. But sometimes that's a technique that is used. Of course, we know he's talking about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. But maybe he's reading, or he anticipated reading the audience as being probably unwilling to embrace a harsher form, because he is still he's still blaming white America. He's still mm-hmm. pointing out where the problem lies, mostly.
Oh yeah, and I don't disagree with what he said. I'm just wondering because I think it goes beyond just white privilege, though.
You know, oh yes.
Because you
can't cover all that ground in one fell swoop. The problem in the United States is so deep, and it's so terrifying to people who are not accustomed to being confronted with the reality in which they have a role to play, in which they are partially responsible.
Yeah.
People sitting in the audience would say, well, that's not me. Well, okay. If the point is to at least raise the subject and to get people to understand that even if they do not acknowledge the problem, there are people, even from among their group, who understand the problem and who are pointing the finger at themselves. So these things you should consider, but I think as a kind of beginner course, it wasn't a bad presentation at all. And all the more so because he was speaking to the problem, to a predominantly white audience, and sharing the blame and saying, this is a problem we have to confront. In a mild way, he did it. Not to chastise, but simply to begin the process of educating people about their direct responsibility for things that they normally would not associate themselves with as having any blame at all.
Okay, well, maybe that's why I was kind of, not understanding it, but, who was he directing these to? Because I'm not white, and, I think I understand, but I'm still learning, about the system of white supremacy. So a lot of stuff that he was saying was kind of like, regurgitated information that I've known already, so it's nothing new, but maybe you're right. Maybe I just like I said, when I read his stuff a couple of years ago, I was kind of interested, but maybe you're right. Maybe I just graduated to
a lot of these level. Points are very familiar to the people on the other end, but for a large percentage of America, they never would see or never thought or still don't think that any blame should be assigned to them. And this is a way to begin to disabuse them of that idea.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling, Henry. We have a few more minutes. I think we could take Kwame's call from New York.
Hi, how you doing, Treat?
Okay, your thoughts?
It was very informative, because even if you're African American, you think but you don't know everything, all the facts. Like the issue of the toxicities was very interesting. The 1 million people. I do have a question. Was he talking also about African Americans who live next to these plants and stuff like that? They've been in their communities for years. Was that what he talked? Was he? That's one of the things he was talking about. Who'd be subjected to, you know, cancers and every type of diseases?
No, I didn't hear that in his speech. What he was saying was that everybody gets sick, everybody gets cancer, everybody gets, you know, some kind of fatal disease, but many, way too many, are just written off.
Right.
And and others get treatment. They get care.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not so much about where people are living. It is about how the system responds to people who have need for care. But
right.
In the figure he quoted was at least 1 million African Americans a year don't get treatment or do not
right.
get equal treatment, medical treatment.
Yeah.
In fact, we had a guest, why am I forgetting her name? But she wrote mm-hmm. a book called Dying right. While Black.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, that's the whole thesis. She's a
right.
medical professional, and she's a professor of
right.
nursing. And she was talking about the fact of the disparity in healthcare. This is not a new
right.
topic, but she certainly did some extraordinary work in pointing out to the disparities, which are well known.
Right.
But despite the fact that they're well known, we haven't seen a good response to it.
Yeah,
thanks for calling, Kwame. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and I so value it. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
I would be caught under the undertow. So you see, I gotta say no. Little.